Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. So why do people like to get high? And when I say get high, I don't just mean, or even principally mean, take drugs or become intoxicated, although it's interesting already to think about why it is that we refer to intoxication, ecstasy, pleasure, transport, journeying, in terms of getting high, as in going up, like up into space, as opposed to down and towards the ground. And this cluster of things that we associate with getting high, which is not just, of course, getting intoxicated, but also getting a better view, transcending, perhaps transcending the body, transcending Earth, going up into the heavens, which is also going up into space. And it becomes a very interesting cluster of associations. You can think about highness as getting as being an archetype, but it's an archetype that is embedded in our everyday body's experience of the world, of orientation. What does it mean to meet somebody who's taller than you, who's shorter than you, when you climb up a hill and you get a nice perspective, when you're stuck down in a gully and can't find your way out? It's very clear that the associations of height and highness go very deep and cross many different levels of our experience. And I kind of first started thinking about this when I was doing the work that went into technosis. And I started to notice again how ideas and images that were associated with mythology or religion, including ones surrounding height and insight, became translated in all these peculiar ways into technology. Even though the people themselves might have left mythological or religious thinking behind them, the power of these models and images kept persisting. And this is the idea of getting high is a very good example of one of those strongly persisting motifs. And it's one that our guest today sort of puts under the microscope a bit in his book, Getting High, A Savage Journey to the Heart of the Dream of Flight, by Kester Bruin, who is a UK writer associated with some radical theological currents that we'll get to later on. And in this book, he really looks at the 60s, and it was a good book to read for me, because while I was very familiar with a lot of the material about the 60s, about the psychedelic revolution on the one hand, and the technological revolution, particularly the revolution of the space flight, Apollo 11, and the whole rhetoric of going to the moon, these two very, very 60s kinds of expansions or very 60s attempts at getting high, were very familiar to me. But it was interesting reading it again, and Kester also was writing about his own life and his own experiences growing up, getting high as a young person, turning on to God, finding the complexities in that, finding his way towards a kind of new way of thinking about the desire to get high in life, in religion, in technology. Was really reflect for me. It was a nice reflection on how it is to grow up in the light of the 60s, which is, I was born in 1967, and so for me that moment has always been a little bit in the rearview mirror, and yet it was incredibly important to me and shapes and continues to shape who I am. And it was interesting to read somebody else's kind of reflection in a way in that mirror, and how significant it is, and how much you can still learn by going back and looking at that story from different angles, particularly around issues of technology and psychedelics, both of which are changing tremendously today. Same thing with religion. So there's a certain way in which it's kind of a, not a mythological place, but a place of stories that you can keep returning to and kind of get different reflections of our own experience today. So with no further ado, I'll welcome Kester onto the show. Hey, Kester, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
So you've written about all sorts of stuff. You've written about pirates. You've written about getting along in a world full of different characters. You've written about magic and the kind of need to go beyond magical metaphors of total superpowers, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It seems like something else was going on with your Getting High book in that while it was also it was a very much an intellectual exploration of history and these motifs and this kind of recurring human desire to transcend and how it manifests in very different things like drugs and technology, there also seemed to be something in your own life that was sort of going on that kind of impelled that. So I know it's a complicated question, but what was it about this Getting Highness that attracted you at this point in your writing career?
I mean, the story of how the book got written is I guess, instructive on that, in that I initially started writing the book out of an argument with the philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who had written some stuff about the infinite in his books. And I teach high school math as my kind of normal day job. And I was like, I said to him, you know, I don't think you've got this right. I mean, I honestly don't think you understand what the infinite really means. It doesn't just mean really big. It means something way beyond that. So the book initially started out as an exploration of what the infinite might be about. And then I kind of started thinking, well, a lot of this is connected with ideas of highness and height and so on. So I then began, writing this book about a history of the human quest for flight. I showed it to a literary agent who said, you know, this is a fantastic book, but there's one story that's missing here. I said, oh, interesting. She said, yeah, your story. There's kind of hints of it there. But and actually, that was a really smart observation because I think I'd been kind of trying to hide it in a way. And no sooner had she said that than kind of weirdly my sister sent me photocopies of her diaries that she'd written when she was very ill, about 10 years old. And this completely floored me. And it gave me this kind of extraordinary dimension into, you know, why I'd been writing what I'd been writing. And I mean, all of my writing has been therapeutic in some ways, but this was kind of then very explicitly like, oh yeah, I know why I'm writing about flight because that's what I've spent all my life doing in different ways too. So I really need to go back and look at this from a personal angle too. And I think, well, I hope, you know, it grounds the book in something that's kind of less academic and is a bit more personal, and certainly for the kind of fields that I've been working in, that's been really important for people reading the book, is that, oh, you know, this isn't just some academic text at all. This is rooted in someone's own trauma and their own experience too.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things to go with from there, but I think I'll pull out the story a little bit more for me before I start hitting you up with my own questions, which is just what it was about your sister's experience and then the way in which that influenced you that set you up on a personal way to confront both the attraction and the sort of dark side, if you will, of this pervasive motif,
yeah,
of getting,
yeah,
high, of transcendence, etc.
So, I mean, I was born in Yorkshire, which is a part of the UK, you know, sort of in the middle, I guess, but was very industrial, kind of very beautiful, kind of in the middle of nowhere in some ways. So I'd never been on an aeroplane. There were no planes flying over my house. And the area where I was living was a real coal mining area. So it was all about the underground and the subterranean. And then when I was probably 6 years old, I went to see the first Star Wars movie. And it completely blew me away. This idea of kind of flight and space and everything. But part of the reason I found it so powerful was because I had a huge amount of trauma and anxiety in my life. I mean, I was kind of 5, 6 years old, but my sister had already been admitted into hospital for a chronic eating disorder. She nearly died from that. And what I hadn't really understood at the time, which is partly what the book is about processing, is how that had come out of kind of serious dysfunction and anxiety and whatever within our family that just wasn't being processed at all. So my father was a church minister, and so his job every Sunday was to take people on high. That was what he was there to do. He was one of these, you know, from the long line of the caste of priests and shamans whose job it is to negotiate our relationship with the above. And yet somehow I began to see that, you know, this kind of access into the heavens was actually about avoiding the trauma on the ground. And being a good, faithful son, that's exactly what I did too. And I started getting very, very serious about religion. And then as I pushed on from that into university days, without critiquing any of it, just pushed on into other means of getting high too. All of it really about lifting away from a ground that I found unbelievably painful. And in a sense, you know, my sister's eating disorder was a form of acquiring weightlessness, perhaps. You know, she wanted to lift away from that trauma too.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's definitely an archetypal or spiritual even aspect to that yeah. disease, you know, and just even the links you can make to saints and nuns, and there's a whole kind of line of that that's going on as well. Yeah. And there's this
fasting and yeah.
Totally, and there is this kind of strange this move that you see being made across all of these you know, different registers, and and one of them, like you said, when you were older, you started to get into drugs and the kind of ecstatic festivals and things like that, and another kind of form of getting high, and yet you maintain, you know, a lot of people go through this process, and maybe they you know, they're religious when they're very young, and then they hit their teenage years and they see a bigger world and they start to explore these other domains. You stayed, or you renegotiated your own relationship to God and religion in these, as you went through these different phases. So what was it like when you were older, when you were had already, you know, been exposed to partying, and you'd gone to Glastonbury and, you know, seen the all the opportunities in the big, wide, largely secular world, especially in the UK? What was it that kept you in proximity to Christianity, even as you came up with a lot of ways, which I want to talk about, of kind of renegotiating that and seeing in it a source of a possibility for new ways of being in the world?
I guess the thing for me is that my experience of it evolved in fairly radical ways. So, you know, kind of early on, it was a much more traditional Church of England experience and all the rest of it. I guess it was kind of medieval. I mean, you know, angels and spiritual powers, and if you do this, you're going to get smitten and what have you. I mean, it was the kind of quite dark, actually, demonic stuff as a young teenager. And, you know, the book that I kind of plodded through was Oswald Chambers' classic, My Utmost for His Highest. So there's all these vectors about angels and higher beings and the rest. So then, you know, at university, that kind of morphed into a real ecstatic form of Christianity. And, you know, there was this kind of new wave of charismatic Christianity. And, you know, particularly after university, that hit a real kind of strange peak in what became known as the Toronto Blessing, which was this kind of incredibly, you know, it's kind of extreme form of ecstatic Christianity, where people were kind of rolling on the floor and howling like animals, and, you know, extraordinary things were meant to be happening in the divine realm and all the rest of it. But basically, people were, you know, I mean, it wouldn't have looked out of place in Timothy Leary's world at all.
You know, I gotta sit in here as a you know, a historian of California. I thought it was very interesting. You know, so much of your book is about California. It's about literally you going there a couple of times and having your own kinds of experiences. It's about the psychedelic revolution, particularly in the West Coast, with Ken Kesey is really in some ways your most important figure. And at the same time, talking about the aerospace and, you know, whatever, the whole kind of technological development. But it's also true that the Christianity that inflamed you out of college also is related to California and its development of that. So I'd love to have you say, I mean, most of our listeners aren't going to know that story. You know, we don't have to go into all the details about Lonnie Frisbee and everything. It's a wonderful story, but I would love to hear a little bit about how you came to understand the origins of this extremely ecstatic, very appealing, communicable, you know, something that is not some dry dogma or some set of strictures. Yeah. I mean, it's a very lively way of being in the world, but it also had to do with a certain kind of California experience.
Absolutely. And the, you know, the odd thing for me is that I didn't know. So my first trip to California was with a friend of mine, and I'd been desperate to go there, and I'm kind of 18 years old. I completely loved Ken Kesey and the whole Merry Pranksters thing, having read Tom Wolfe's book. So, you know, we're kind of cruising around Haight-Ashbury, seeing all of that. But then, you know, going immediately within days from there down to Orange County and the Vineyard Church run by this guy, John Wimber, which was a kind of mecca for charismatic Christians at the time. And me basically thinking, well, I can't mention where I've just been because everyone will think that's, you know, completely crazy and totally separate. And they probably would have done. But what I didn't realize is that the origins were completely the same place. So the guy, Lonnie Frisbee, you mentioned, you know, he's tripping on acid. He has this very powerful experience of Jesus. He decides to start a church. He gets called into a church meeting with this guy who ends up as John Wimber. So the whole kind of Vineyard movement of churches comes directly out of the LSD counterculture, absolutely directly. And it's the same kind of ideas of this kind of very free consciousness. There's a real kind of element of divine power running through it, kind of ecstatic tongues, all these kind of visions, and drawing power from God. You know, all of these things that come directly from the same place. But I had no idea until literally a couple of years ago, when a friend in LA on another visit there told me that story, and I was completely floored. I couldn't believe it, that this thing that I thought was so separate was in fact the same. And it then became kind of my hunch that, you know what, I think everyone was having their counterculture. It just depending on different social strata, you know, the hippies were having their counterculture, the Christians were having their counterculture. You know, those in the scientific community, you know, were kind of doing the Apollo thing. And they all kind of came from the same ground, I think. And, of course, there's massive blurrings between them.
Yeah. And then you know, the sort of main theme that you're kind of drawing out of all this is the profound limitations that occur when in our lives, whether we're, you know, fetishizing technology and the future development in space flight, or we're fetishizing our next, you know, euphoric visionary experience, or the next time we go and gather with our fellow believers and have these experiences of divine ecstasy and insight, that in all of these, you know, however cool and interesting and valuable and yummy those things can be and insightful, that there is a dark side to them, and a dark side that has really, really serious consequences. So in your own life, I mean, we can talk, you know, in your book, you talk about what in all of these stories, particularly with space flight and particularly with psychedelics, how there was a kind of down, this inevitable down, the crash, how are people going to deal with it? Are they going to just try to latch onto something new? Are they going to look at the challenges of what it means to live on the other side of the high? But in your own life, how, since you in some ways were pursuing the high, if you will, through your religion as well as your interest in these kinds of topics, esoteric topics, mystical topics, even some you know, drug cultures, when did you start going, you know, there's something off about this continual need to recreate the flight and to avoid the consequences of the come down?
I mean, I guess so after college, I got into this kind of massively charismatic thing with religion, and it was kind of on the other side of that where I was just a little bit worried by some of the things I was seeing. And in fact, maybe the first seed of doubt was the girl I was dating at the time. She wasn't getting any of this. It was, you know, she was desperate for some extraordinary ecstatic experience. And no matter how much she sang and how much she prayed, you know, she didn't get anything, which obviously was like, oh, you know, a bit awkward for me, whatever. And it then made me just open my eyes a little bit. And gradually out of that, I began to see more and more of that. Now, I then ended up setting up a kind of community of artists called Vox, who were kind of interested in exploring, you know, various topics around urban spirituality and those sorts of things. And that became a kind of virus of deconstruction around my faith, I guess. And it began, you know, with deconstructing the Christianity that I'd been brought up in. And I actually started Vox with a great friend called Nick, who was a fantastic graphic designer and had worked on Wired magazine in the UK. His father had also been a minister. He'd been through the kind of same worlds, and we really hit it off. But what really kind of brought the crunch, I suppose, and the real crisis a few years ago, which kind of opened up the void that had always been there, was him dying of cancer just 3 years ago. And that kind of brutally made me look back at all these different mechanisms, you know, in the face of someone about to be lowered into the ground, and kind of in the 10 months where he was diagnosed and knowing he was going to die, talking about all of this, and talking about the different illusions we'd been through, and that healthy disillusion of looking beyond that when you know you're going to die.
Yeah, that'll cut through cut through things well.
Yeah, I don't recommend it, but my God, the stuff is strong.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so many things again to play with here, but I guess just running forward with that, I'm kind of curious about, well, when you talk about Vox, which sounded like a really interesting thing, and I'd love to hear a little bit about some of the events that you guys did. One of the things that interests me, and it's always interested me a great deal, though I was not raised a Christian. I spent some time as a Christian when I was mm-hmm. in high school, very briefly, with a kind of charismatic scene. It didn't work for me very much, but it's always stayed with me as a kind of point of reference.
Yeah.
And I've always been really drawn to people who have faith or come from a faith background, or have had, even as adults, a deep immersion, and then they begin to deconstruct it, and you know, both in the technical sense of applying deconstructive tools to religion, which creates all sorts of interesting possibilities that aren't simply atheists by any stretch of the imagination, but they begin to deconstruct the religion. And even start to come to places that are even a little bit more existential and even bleak than your average secular person is in terms of looking at the conditions. And yet there's some way in which they are not atheist, that there's a continued relation with whatever that current is, whether it's in the books or the ideas or merely the history or the images. But there's some way in which, even as there's a deconstruction, there's still a kind of productive relationship to it. And that sounds to me something that was very much a part of Vox. So before we talk about the full plunge in the face of, you know, facing the grave, I would like to hear a little bit about Vox and how you were blending urban spirituality with the, you know, with a kind of deconstructive ethos, and yet still carrying on, confirming, exploring what it means to be a person of faith.
I mean, you know what, like so many great creative expressions, it began with boredom. Like, Nick and I were just so fucking bored sitting in church thinking, you know, look around us, there's TV producers here, there's actors, there's dancers, there's incredibly gifted people here. And what we've got is stand up, sit down with a hymn, you know, maybe a bit of flower arranging and a couple of people playing guitar. This just like just artistically wasn't good enough. So we began Vox really as an architectural practice. Like, we were going to design a space within which people could express themselves in whatever language, you know, came to them. And so we, you know, an event was, I guess, a little bit like one of Kesey's acid tests. You know, you had all kinds of stuff going off, whether that was dancing, whether that was people writing stuff, whether that was kind of movement, whether that was artistic installation, We installed waterfalls into places. We kind of explored some all kinds of interesting narratives. We did a series of three events all around the idea of dirt and the idea of the place of dirt and how important dirt is. So using the ideas of purity and danger and that kind of stuff, that dirt is kind of intrinsic to how we organize our societies. But as we did that, I think gradually, if you're prepared to start opening that box, then it becomes very difficult to sustain an orthodox set of beliefs. And that for me was massively liberating. This was just like some of the best times, you know, just the kind of boldness and courage to be able to go into anything. You know, nothing was off limits, and we were able to help people give voice to doubts, to a whole load of fun and kind of expression that they'd simply not been able to do. I mean, the first few services, to be honest, it was a bit like everyone just vomiting. I mean, there was just mess everywhere. They all came out, you know, and then you kind of think, oh, hold on a minute, you know, we should probably try and curate this a little more interestingly, which we did, and we were going for about 10 years. And what's, you know, fascinating by the end of it is Vox had become a vehicle that had created its own destruction. I mean, we didn't need it anymore. And once that has happened, you need to get rid of it. You need to move on. So we killed it. We shot it dead, and we had a funeral for it, and then we had a kind of celebration. And it was like, okay, you know, it did its job. It deconstructed us, and now we need to move on from here. To keep doing it would just be a kind of fetishistic move. It was right. Kind of pointless. Well,
so now what was different between that if you look at that whole process and where you wound up after the 10 years, what was different between that and, let's say, you know, sitting down and, you know, reading books by radical atheists and suddenly realizing that their arguments are true and that you've been keeping this illusion alive and it's horseshit, and, you know, are you going to leave it aside and just accept the world and the terms that it's laid out for in a kind of strictly atheist point of view? There's something different that happens when you deconstruct it, even though in the end you wind up in a non-orthodox place where you're open to all these possibilities. You're not really a Christian in any the way that most Christians would describe a Christian.
No.
But so what's the difference there, though?
So I guess, you know, to begin with, Christianity had, you know, it always wanted to position itself as external to all kind of culture, to all cultural processes, and that became completely unsustainable. So this idea of an external divinity, this external source of final truth, you know, that kind of falls away. And this is where the kind of, this, you know, this kind of beautiful overlap with Technosis, which is a book I just completely love, is you know, as you kind of beautifully expose, that whether it's LSD or Apollo or religion, they're all technologies, you know, and they're all religious too, in that they're all tools we've honed from the natural world around us to provide us with some means of lift, as it were. And yet they're all psychedelic in the sense of they reveal the soul. They're all trying to uncover something of our deeper drives. So the reason why I don't kind of go for the radical atheist position is I just don't think it makes sense to understand the world as ever being free of gods. Like, for me, there are gods everywhere, you know, and probably the biggest around is the god of capitalism, in that it's this system which places enormous demands on us, and it presents itself as having a kind of external truth, you know, this permanent thing. And for me, actually, to sustain a position of radical atheism would be to deny that that's the case. Whereas for me, I look around and see people worshipping gods all the time. So I don't deny that there are gods around. I just think the fascinating thing about Christianity is that it can become a machine by which gods are put to death. You know, so there's this great idea of a non-transcendent Christianity which kind of stops at the cross. Like, okay, this is where we put our gods to death. And in this process of the mass, we're not celebrating a resurrection, we're celebrating a death. we're celebrating the putting down of all our gods, all these systems that pretend to be external and transcendent and actually end up screwing us up. You know,
yeah.
they all create these enormous demands on us. You know, so you get people in traditional Christianity saying, oh, you know, I'd love it to be okay that you're gay, but you know, God says I can't, or the Bible says I can't. So there's these, you know, external figures of authority which actually end up diminishing your humanity. And that to me is insane. You know, this is dehumanizing us. So it's about putting these gods to death on a regular basis. And, you know, looking forward into a kind of future of AI and you know, this kind of heavy dependence on digital technologies, I kind of see that those technologies are also putting a demand on us which dehumanizes, you know, in the way which we interact with our children and the way in which we kind of see breakdown in kind of relationship and community because we're all craning our necks at these screens. Again, there's something of a divine promise in what these screens are offering us and holding out to us, and yet they don't deliver. So again, you know, for me, this kind of radical, incredibly heretical Christianity is about going through the motions of putting those to death, you know?
Yeah, no, that's wonderfully said. Also, it reminds me of I'm sure aspects of Zizek, who you mentioned earlier, who you,
sure.
you would buy. I think he does a marvelous job of,
yeah.
Of explaining the sort of, you know, the religion of Christ on the cross, the religion of the forsaken moment. And,
yeah.
And I, you know, I think that's a really powerful image. I mean, obviously there's other things to say about him and his relationship with
Christ. Yeah. I mean, I think just to jump from there, because then, you know, a lot of Christians then say to me, well, what about the resurrection? You know? And, you know, I was kind of thinking through that question too. And I was, writing and presenting a radio program for BBC Radio in the UK, and I invited onto the program a philosopher called Simon Critchley, who's a professor at the New School in New York. And I said to him, hey, you know, tell me, what do you think about the resurrection? And we were kind of talking about some of this stuff. And he said, I believe in the afterlife. I believe in the life of those who come after. And that flipped it for me completely. That's so beautiful for me, that the resurrection is not about us being resurrected. It's that those we leave behind can look at our lives and get up and walk away and live again. You know, they need to live again. So, I, you know, the resurrection is me living a life so that my children are funded to live on once I'm gone. You know, I don't want to be resurrected physically myself. I do want other people to be able to get up from the grave and walk away and say, ah, you know, I've got some stuff that will fund my life and go onwards, you know?
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. I mean, we had Simon on the show talking about
great.
The Faith of the Faithless, which is a great book. People
really great, you know,
really encouraged to read yeah. that one along these lines. And as a rebuttal to other kinds of gods in the horizon, including a lot of radical political violence, which he has some real concerns
yes.
with. So I find yeah. that stream to be a very, now one way of looking at the problem then mm-hmm. is that it seems that there is something inherent and positive about our desire for some kind of ecstasy or transcendence, whether it's something that we experience, you know, physiologically, whether it's
yeah.
something we aim for, and that part of the problem, like if you look at the way that digital technology is eroding community and people's embodied relationship with other bodies and within all the sort of negative sides of it, the way that, I mean, I'm not getting into a big I don't want to get into a Neil Luddite conversation, but just mm-hmm. the specific mm-hmm. ways in which screens themselves are capturing attention and rerouting it in ways that are, at least to my view, obviously negative in many ways.
Yeah.
Is that part of that, if we take this ecstasy idea seriously, is like part of the reason that's happening is that people's inherent or potential desire for transcendence, for movement, for voyaging, for a new world, all that stuff, is getting captured and constrained by these devices and these networks. So in a way, and then when you look at the same kind of issue with like people who are studying religion, and on the one hand, or, you know, whether it's Buddhism or ayahuasca religion or Christianity or whatever, when they're like, on the one hand, they're very motivated, they have they're ethically driven, they have they're very earnest, they're trying to be, and yet you can sometimes see that, oh wow, actually all they're really doing is they found a very clever way of kind of getting off, and they keep repeating it in new ways. But there's something about that way in which we also want to get off or get higher, get that bigger picture. So the question I have for you in thinking about it is, what is the appropriate relationship to our own desire to get high? How do we accept that part of ourselves as a real driver, but not get caught in the problems that you talk about, the kind of denial, the unwillingness to face reality, to face the body, to face death, the constant putting off of these kind of consequences. Obviously, there's some very negative sides to this returning to getting high. So what is a way that you, even personally or just culturally, what do you see as a way to kind of acknowledge and work with that, but in a more positive way?
I mean, this is why I would be critical of this, of the kind of radical atheist move, because it wants to deny any of that and just tell everybody that any attempt at that is completely nonsense and is unfruitful and all the rest. I don't believe that at all. You know, for me, I think the real ground is that our consciousness is so extraordinary, is completely extraordinary, and it's therefore, however it came about, desperate to discover some meaning for itself. And that's why there's this constant generation of illusions that there must have been this higher thing that created it, some top level revelation of the fundamental connection of all things, and so we go after that in any way we can. And in one sense, LSD and Apollo and you know, charismatic Christianity, they've all offered that same thing. They've all offered a kind of lift up to that point. Now, the way in which they, all of them, initially did that was to say, you know, if we get high, then we can bring peace to the earth. And you see this explicitly, you know, the very beginnings of LSD, people have genuine high hopes that it could change the way we behave with one another and stop wars and all the rest of it. And, you know, there's this really, really long history of the moon being the site of Eden. And if we can get to the moon, then all wars will cease and all the rest of it. And Christianity does the same thing. But so they all begin with, if we can lift away, then we can help everyone to become, you know, saved, or the earth will become peaceful. But what they then morph into is, if we can lift away, we're not going to come back. I.e. they become modes of escape. Now, that's where I think the problems lie, that whenever a technology presents itself as a means of escape rather than a means of gaining perspective, then it becomes problematic. Because in that sense, it is saying that we want to leave the corrupt earth behind. I mean, and you see that like right at the beginnings of flight, right back to the Montgolfier brothers, and you look at the very first balloon flights and how they were saying, you know, the air above is charming to breathe, and leaving the corrupt earth behind and all the rest of it. So that we've already got this idea of escape. And, you know, the Apollo missions were meant to be, if you read Oriana Fallaci's brilliant book, If the Sun Dies, you know, moves towards escaping the earth forever, because the earth is corrupt, the earth is bad, it's all going down the pan, all the rest of it. And Kesey, you know, and others are kind of looking not to help save the world anymore, but to escape it. So for me, flight is most wonderful when it allows us a perspective to then come back down and do good. And it's most worrying when it becomes a mechanism of escaping, wanting never to come back. So I embrace flight in the sense of it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. You know, I mean, flying in an aeroplane just gives you that beautiful moment of reflection and meditation. And all of these mechanisms of flight are wonderful as long as they're not about escape. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it doesn't. It does make a lot of sense. I mean, I also think about, if you're paying attention, if you're keeping your eyes open, you can sort of, even the experiences of getting high, or even the sort of appeals of new technology or the new powers that come with getting an expanded view, that they also deconstruct themselves if you're paying attention. You know, that there is a way in which, even just staying with the thing itself, it's like if you really look at technology and the history of technology, and you look at all the unintended consequences, you look at all the ways in which power gets redeployed and new forms of exploitation and new forms of domination accrue. Yeah. I mean, if you really look at the whole thing, as well as acknowledging the good, you see the way that it kind of deconstructs itself. And I think that's true with spirituality.
And this is, you know, this is where I try and use Martin Heidegger in the book. Who, you know, it's not an easy guy to read in anyone's book, but his book on the question concerning technology is really smart. And at this point in the book, I'm seeing religion as a technology as well. But he says, you know, all technologies, they all perform acts of revelation, and they all open the world to us in new ways. And you can see how LSD did that. You can see how Apollo does that. You know, it gives you this extraordinary heights from which to look down on the world. He says, but what's more difficult to see is that all technologies also inframe us. They also drive out every other possible means of revelation. So they all kind of seem to make a claim that theirs is the only form of revelation, as it were. And I think you're right in that if you pay attention, and if you are kind of broad in your use of technologies, actually, you begin to see that all of them have that means of enframing. And therefore, we always need to look for where that enframing lies. You know, so something like Spotify, it's like, wow, it's amazing. You know, it opens up and reveals to you all this great new music. But then actually, if all you do is use Spotify, you're going to end up not discovering some really, really wonderful music that just isn't there. But it wants to claim that it's all there. So there's this kind of bedazzling that all religions do. You know, Christianity would have you go nowhere else. But you're right in the sense that as soon as we begin to understand that, we can critique it and we can then look for wherever the inframing is. And that's a really healthy thing to do, because it allows you to kind of drop back down again and to see where the limits are, and then to kind of shift in a different way as you're kind of looking at the technologies, you know, in different perspectives too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I also wanted to pick up again on an earlier theme you talked about. About death and how much your friend Nick's death, you know, woke you up even to perhaps even a deeper level, which you may be hiding from certain limitations by recapitulating certain forms of flight, and you know, there's a very interesting kind of relationship between death and technology in that way, and the technology can so often be a sort of prevention, a sort of a shield, or even a vision of a kind of afterlife. How was the reality of your friend's death? How did that change? Since you're already, you know, we all think about death at some point, where, you know, the religion is all about death, you know, all the stuff's going on. But then when you had the kind of existential experience of it, how did it shake you up in ways that you hadn't been shaken up before?
I mean, I guess, you know, so he had cancer of the liver, and he, you know, he knew he was going to die, but it was his reaction to that, which was to say, okay, look, you know, there isn't going to be a miracle. And in fact, you know, we are all heading towards that place. And one of the phrases he took from Gary Sinder's book, The Practice of the Wild, was, you know, each one of us at the table must accept that one day we'll be part of the meal. In other words, our bodies are going to be reintegrated into this earth. We are going to be lowered down into the earth, and we're going to kind of, you know, disappear and come back to it. And to present ourselves as separate from that is to kind of remove ourselves from the cycles of life, which is to kind of subtract away from what the earth has, as it were. So he was really about embracing that death, which had come to him too soon. He was very much about grieving that properly, rather than trying to, you know, ignore that fact, as it were. I mean, people would say, "Can I pray for you?" And, you know, because we obviously had a lot of Christian friends, and that was a kind of interesting thing for him. You know, his father was a minister as well. And him saying, "Look, you know, I've got to understand that this is what my body is doing to me. Not that it's welcome, not that he didn't go for treatment. Of course he did. But he knew that it was only going to sustain him for a little longer." So I guess for me, what that was about was understanding how the process of death functions in all of us. And I think that links back to the earlier work that I'd done on pirates and pirate culture, who very much took on this idea that they were going to die. I mean, their skull and crossbones motif, which we see everywhere, is a kind of acceptance of death as part of life. And, you know, as Montaigne said, you know, to philosophize is to know how to die. So there was that idea that all philosophy actually should help you to understand how you're going to die. And once you've understood how you're going to die, well then, okay, how am I now going to live and really live?
Yeah, very much so. And I think it also relates to this. You mentioned this question of consciousness, and that how a lot of our urge for ecstasy and transcendence and the ways in which that gets, you know, brought into different cultural formations and technologies has to do with this kind of this sprightliness of consciousness itself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and, absolutely.
And the thought about death is that the more that you kind of accept that you're in this body and the body's going to go back, that in my experience anyway, that the delight, the magic, the ecstasy, the transcendence of consciousness is more and more visible simply in this life. Like, I don't need to go to the Grand Canyon or to, you know, take ayahuasca or to pray or, you know, for all day long or whatever to get to a place. Sometimes, not always, not even often, but there's often times in my life as I feel like I've been working on this kind of material that you know that we're talking about, that consciousness itself, just the sheer fact of experiencing the world, this world with its objects, with its frustrations even, there's a brightness to it, a vividness to it that in a way satisfies me much more than it did when I was young, where that didn't work. That didn't make any sense. I needed something much more powerful to feel attached to or to be in relation with. And so I think that is one of those gifts of philosophy or of, you know, contemplating death or of sort of accepting the cycle of life or embracing the skull and crossbones and the piratical metaphor, is that there's a vividness that is then granted to life that actually increasingly satisfies the urge for ecstasy, at least in my experience.
No, I think that's exactly right. And I think it is extremely satisfying to do that on the other side of that process. So, I mean, you know, people say to me, you know, what do things look like on the other side, as it were? And I'm saying, look, this isn't all about kind of death and kind of gloominess at all. It's quite the opposite. There's something really beautiful about once you've accepted that really, as you say, opens the world up to you. I mean, you know, what's kind of fascinating about the 60s, just to go back to that, is that, you know, people talk about it as this kind of wonderful decade of love and all the rest of it, but it was a place of enormous fear. I mean, you know, the prospect of nuclear apocalypse, you know, kind of mass death was huge. And that really had a profound effect on people's desire to lift away into something which would stop that happening. So and this is the idea of the heavens, this idea of this eternal thing, this kind of Platonic idea of the return to the source. And you get Norman Mailer saying, when he sees the Saturn V rocket liftoff, you know, now we've got something with which to speak to God. And, you know, the same with this kind of angelic form of the iPhone or whatever, where it's, you know, it's instant messaging and it's kind of, it can do these extraordinary things of kind of omniscience and all the rest. It's almost like this divine object. And what that's doing is, again, making some promise that it can sustain life even further. And I think, you know what, once you've accepted that, just like the phone that's going to slow down and die and end up in the earth, you know, so are we. But there's something much more beautiful on the other side of that. Something about accepting the material world as it is that means that it is even more extraordinary even more extraordinary that we kind of, in this entropic way, kind of rise from it for a while and then are just going to fall back down again another time.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. It's funny, I was reading the other day a book, and they were talking about trying to figure out like the sort of archetype of our civilization, and they were talking about Faust and how in older periods of our history we would think about Faust, you know, as a sort of image of modernity. And in a weird way, it's sort of a little bit gone away now, a little bit eclipsed, even though, as you write about in your book on magic, that metaphors of magic and of sort of superpowers and of using techniques and technologies to sort of magnify our powers have only really, expanded. And I wonder sometimes that how much we are still kind of, you know, living in a sort of, Faustian framework, which also connects up both with psychedelics and with high technology, a little bit less so with charismatic Christianity for obvious reasons, but there is a sort of way of that kind of figure of that sort of self-transforming figure. Yes. And clearly we're in the Faustian bargain. I mean, we're not, you know, you and I can have this marvelous conversation, but the bargain has been made, and the results are piling high.
Absolutely. I would totally connect the whole charismatic Christianity thing with a kind of Faustian pact, because, you know, Faust is this kind of bored academic, and he wants to go higher. He wants to lift up into kind of divine knowledge, and his technology for doing that is to summon a spirit or summon a demon. Well, you know, you go to a charismatic worship service, people are summoning the spirit the whole time, and they're doing that in order to access some higher knowledge. And people would talk about, you know, prophecy and words of wisdom and some form of higher intelligence and all the rest of it. So, again, there is this kind of Faustian drive to that. And of course him, you know, in the play and in the kind of myth is kind of dealing with that in terms of magic. But, As I kind of talk about in the book, that's intimately connected to the ideas of memory and thus to the ideas of the mind and of how the mind works, and thus to kind of technology of remembrance and of the internet and all of these kind of things. And actually, all of these technologies are highly psychedelic in that they reveal something very deep in the soul, which is, you know, beautifully explored by the Faust myth about that we want to be divine. Effectively, we all want to push beyond this kind of material limitation into something else, but when we do that, something gets corrupted and our humanity gets diminished and we end up seriously screwing up, which is going to be, you know, that kind of interesting question coming up now. I mean, the quote I give, which a lot of people have talked about, of Elon Musk, you know, being asked, oh, hey, you know, what do you think about AI? And he kind of says, well, it's a bit like the guy summoning the demon. Like, we think we've got it in control, but we haven't. But, it's a demon that already possesses us. It's not some external demonic force. There's no point saying that technology is demonic or whatever. I mean, that's the kind of stupid Luddite view, is to say, look, it's already within us. It's this basic human thing within our consciousness that desires to go higher, that wants something bigger than itself to explain itself. And my argument is, you know what, we've got to come to an acceptance of that and understand how that works out and what the kind of good parts of that are, and also how we need to kind of put that to death on a regular basis.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also going to be coming up not just with AI, but with virtual reality. I mean, already the rhetoric around virtual reality it draws so much from drugs and from transcendental experiences and from, you know, all these things, and that, you know, that's just going to bring all sorts of experiences to people's lives. And as we get better and, you know, the psychopharmaceuticals and whatever, so our ability to generate states of profound ecstasy and transport are just becoming easier and easier and easier. So until we kind of develop a way of like integrating the stuff in a little bit more balanced way, we're going to see the same sort of off-kilter responses.
But you see, the interesting thing to me, as you mentioned about the politics of it, you know, the promise that these technologies hold out is some kind of access of divine knowledge, or, you know, you can become more godlike in that sense of multiple presences and omnipresence and all the rest of it. But the question I try and pose in the book is, you know, who is it that is really becoming functionally divine? And for me, you know, it's the NSA, it's over in the UK, GCHQ, it's the apparatus of the state or of Google or of the kind of, you know, big technology that's harvesting so much information from us so that, you know, it knows the very hairs on our head, to draw on a line of scripture. I mean, you know, this is what's becoming functionally divine. And yet, in order to do that, they have to make this promise to us that it's us who are becoming divine, which goes right back to the kind of myth of Hermes and Apollo and the birth of technology and all these things. You know, this is how technology is born, an act of theft from the gods. But, you know, is it us who are becoming divine? I really don't think so. I think that's the promise we're given. But actually, someone else is becoming way more divine than me, you know.
Somebody else is definitely becoming more rich.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so there's a kind of old painting I talk about, part of a medieval triptych about Simon the magician, you know, who's kind of called into the court of Nero, and Simon Peter is there as well. And, you know, Simon the magician performs the miracle of flight, which, of course, you know, in kind of pre-Enlightenment days was seen as a sinful act. And Simon Peter, the apostle, you know, he prays, and of course, Simon the magician comes plunging down and his face gets smashed and it's all bloody. So there's this kind of idea of, you know, who can lift you? Is it Jesus, or is this kind of platonic other technology, higher knowledge thing? But the one person who is right there causing all of this is Nero. You know, it's the head of state. It's the person who remains seated throughout, who demands that flight must be made by whatever technologies are there. And that's where we've got to have the political question is, you know, who are the people who are demanding that we fly? You know, who are the people demanding that, you know, we have to absorb these new technologies in order to become better, purer, more wonderful people? Yeah, I'm not sure we've kind of got to grasp fully with those questions.
That is the question. That is the question. And it takes me back to a Gnostic and arguably Pauline perspective as well on the powers of the world. You know, I think that model of the archons and that the world as it's run as a human space has these forces behind it that in some sense we can't help but capitulate to, and yet should never be confused with the Most High.
Exactly, the Most High, served by the priests.
Yeah, you know, Kessler, we're going to have to wind it up here, so thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It's been great. Thank you so much for having me on.
So that was Kester Bruin, Getting High, A Savage Journey to the Heart of the Dream of Flight. And you can find out more about Kester and his other books at kesterbruin.com. Next week, we'll be talking to Brian Kottner about alchemy and art. So until then, keep your minds open.